Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. Always nice to have you with us today. Instead of doing all the different articles from the different journals, I'm going to give a classroom on the air to begin our program about superfoods, the health-boosting properties that, at a time when we need to have a strong immune system, act as functional foods and can build up the immune system. I suggest that you take some notes, because some things may seem self-evident, but what's in an apple? Why would I suggest then that you have 4 apple skins thrown into a blender each day? You can juice the rest of the apple, but those have particular nutrients. Most of the nutrients are in the skin, like quercetin. So I'm going to go through this in some length, and I hope that you will be able to benefit by making yourself stronger. Also today, we're going to take on some issues. I'm going to report on one of the people who is well known within the progressive and liberal community, who has helped a lot of causes, done a lot of good work. And he raises some issues concerning about the trust in the vaccine. He trusts the vaccine. He trusts the CDC. Fine. I'll read his response. I won't mention his name. And then I'll respond to it along with Richard Gale. I'm sure you're all aware now that we've been told if you're not vaccinated, you're an enemy of the people. You're shamed, you're ridiculed, you're mocked. There's a new form of apartheid. It's vaccine apartheid in the United States. What you're excluded from. The bonus is get vaccinated, 2 vaccines, and then multiple boosters. We don't know how many you need the boosters. They've been proven. Put the brakes on. Nothing has been proven. Nothing. Not a single scientist in the world with any authority of fact can say that the vaccines are safe and effective at this moment. You can't say something at the beginning of a study. You have to wait 3, 4, 5 years at the end of the study. Then you can use that data. Why is everyone who is pro-vaccine not looking at all of the lethal and morbid outcomes to hundreds of thousands of people who are now in the hospital, who may be injured for life? Oh, it's just an infinitesimal. Says who? I have the actual government statistics. They're not a small number. And why aren't the nurses and doctors being vaccinated? They're the ones working with people every day because they see the truth. And that gives them a different perspective. So we're going to deal with all these, but we're also going to deal with some other things. I'm going to read you a short bio from 1975 to 2021 about one person and see who I'm talking about. Also, today, there was a reason to challenge the CDC as a believable and reliable source of information, especially ones that can impact our lives. I found an audio clip that challenges that. Also, there were only a handful of us. When I say handful, I mean just a small handful, probably no more than 10 to 15 people who were able to weather the attacks from those in the AIDS community who had wrapped themselves around Burroughs Wellcome's philosophy that it's hit them hard, hit them strong with AZT. Well, take a look behind you. You're responsible for hundreds of thousands of deaths. It's time that story was told. And so today, one person, Kim Iverson, is going to give you a real ringside seat to Anthony Fauci and how he completely mishandled the entire AIDS epidemic. And he's doing the same thing now with COVID. But it's her. I don't know her. Haven't spoken to her. But the information that we have gleaned, she also has. Also, investigative journalist, I believe he was with, and maybe still is, with an important investigative reporting group, The Intercept, Ryan Grimm. He is going to show where the evidence against Julian Assange, and we have Randy Credico, a tireless fighter for truth, and America's leading supporter, at least in the media, on Julian Assange. But all the evidence is been shattered. The government has no case. You'll hear that exclusively. So here's a question. Why is it with all of the information that we now have of what Julian Assange has actually done and the protections he should be afforded with his First Amendment rights, why is it none of the liberal press has gone to his defense? I could understand the conservatives. They don't want to defend anyone who exposes their corruption. But what the hell has happened to the so-called liberal or progressive media? They're supporting the CDC, the FDA, mandatory vaccines, shaming people, the CIA, the National Security Agency. This is something that should be cast into a different light today. And also, Ryan Grimm also asks why the CDC needs to be prosecuted now that the war in Afghanistan is over. These are just some of the issues we're taking on. Julian Assange, prosecuting those responsible. But I'm going to broaden that out a lot. I'll have a little commentary about, well, here's a question, and I'll ask it right now. You can call in later and share your thoughts. There's been over, we know of, and can document, it's a matter of historical accuracy, 59 interventions in other countries' democratically elected governments. In every case, we have caused the harassment, arrest, torture, and slaughter of countless numbers of people. We will never know the true numbers. And Operation Condor, there's Henry Kissinger. And this is all over the world. Not a single person has been held accountable. Not one. Abu Ghraib, the sodomizing, the brutalizing of the prisoners there, none of whom had been convicted. No one was held accountable above a certain rank. What about all the rapes within the armed forces? Nobody's held accountable. What about all the lies of every administration? Doesn't matter who's in power. Not a single person in power was held accountable. Nothing happens to these people, ever. But maybe I'm wrong. Mention all of the crimes against the FBI, and I couldn't broadcast all of them if I spoke very fast within this hour. Not a single person held accountable. The CIA, National Security Agency, whistleblowers exposing corruption in every one of these agencies, they are attacked. Obama did more than all the other presidents to attack whistleblowers. Not a thing, not a criticism. He has an open birthday party, and anywhere between 400 or 500 people show up unmasked. But that's fine. They're all celebrities. I guess the celebrities breathe a different air, are less susceptible. No criticism by the mainstream media. One criticism was from Rim McDowell in the New York Times. I read it. It was a good piece, and that went nowhere. As if you don't say anything bad, we don't punish, we don't prosecute anyone who is in political power. But over here, yes, we will. You and I, the average citizens. So think of it. These are the very people, the very institutions, the very governmental agencies, the very members of Congress who are telling you, you must do something with your body. It's no longer yours, it's theirs. They have a sovereignty over your body. Now they're coming for your mind. Why don't you just step back and say, okay, you want control over my life, my judgment, where I should live, what I should do, if I can have a job or not, if I can fly or not. You want to punish me? Let's take a look at you. Not once, not a sentence anywhere in the American media about the decrepit condition of everyone in the media, every institution in America, every agency, every major corporation, every CEO, all psychopaths, sociopaths, completely corrupt, not a criticism, nothing. How masochistic you have to be in order to allow those who do nothing but gain power and abuse it, all without ever honoring any of the pledges to make it a better world. And if you doubt me, look at the trillions of dollars that we spend and show me which city is better today because of it. Show me the 30 million hungry Americans who have food. Show me the senior citizens living in abject poverty and lonely. Show me, and you can't. So you're allowing these people to moniker you? Why can't we ever hold people who cause the problem responsible? Just an idea. I'd like to hear your thoughts. 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. Now we're going to, by the way, I have a really interesting guest on Progressive Commentary Hour. If Jane Goodall is the ambassador for the animal kingdom, I believe she is, and Vandana Shiva is the ambassador for seeds and protecting the heirloom seeds in the land, and she is, then Diana Burchford Kroeger is unquestionably the world ambassador speaking on behalf of the world's trees and forest. I know of no other person who possesses the wisdom of the forest as Diana. And she has multiple PhDs. She will be on Conversations with Remarkable Minds on Progressive Commentary Hour, discussing with me tonight the risk of losing our forest and how optimistic should we be about climate change. You won't want to miss that, 7 p.m. Now, let's go to something that's very important, and that is how we individually, no matter what our doctors say, oh, you're sick, stay at home, stay in bed, don't do anything, and then when you're too sick, go to the hospital. No, there's a lot you can do. Excuse me. In fact, go back to the very beginning of this crisis. There were four articles written over a four-month period. Richard Gale and myself did the research. Every single article was written based upon all the information coming from the Library of Medicine, peer-reviewed journals, on how you can naturally build up your immune system and protect yourself against all forms of pathogens, including COVID and other viruses and bacteria, pneumonia, etc. Think of how many people have downloaded those and used them to their benefit and have been able to weather the storm, including how many people have been infected with COVID and didn't know it because their immune system was strong enough. So, I want other people now who have not done anything to realize you have a lot you could do to help yourself, especially with people who have comorbidities. So don't look for the high-tech solutions. No, this is something much, much more basic. I call it the superfood enhancing of your bodily processes. I'm going to start off with just 18 foods. First, we start with the apples, one of nature's most perfect foods. For thousands of years, apples, the malus group, have been used to address numerous medical conditions, including diabetes, fevers, inflammatory disorders. There's your heart, there's your lung, there's your brain, there's your liver and your kidneys, inflammation, and of course, even serious heart ailments like congestive heart failure. And mind you, these are all pieces of a puzzle. I'm not going to suggest that any one of these is all you need. No, you need a whole group of things. So what happens is that the apple is loaded with phytonutrients, and one phytochemical found in apples is a natural antibiotic, and it's called Floretin, Phloretin. Apples also contain pectin and pectic acids, and that adds bulk to your intestine in a soft way, like blueberries do, and that helps people who have inflammatory conditions like irritable bowel and also GERD, generally from drinking caffeine. So that soothes the intestine. It brings needed moisture in there and helps clean up the intestinal debris. Now, that's not all. Apples also contain tannins, T-A-N-N-I-N-S, quercetin, Q-U-E-R-C-E-T-I-N, and alpha farnesyl, and what is called shikimic acid and chlorogenic acids. Now, these acids, which you really won't taste, but they have enormous health benefits. In fact, by increasing the production of the neurotransmitter acetylcholine, for example, they help offset cognitive decline due to oxidative damage. So all the people I know who are suffering from any form of cognitive decline in Alzheimer's, I'll always have them having a juice, generally 16 ounces a day, with lemon and the whole skin, green apple and the whole skin, because these are rich in phenols and polyphenols and rich in antioxidants, and they're also chemoprotective. So people having had cancer treatments, and especially if they've had cancer, let's say surgery and then chemotherapy, I know people, in fact, right now I'm helping save a person's life who was dying of the chemotherapy. One treatment, got the call from the family. She's not moving. She's in, won't even open her eyes. One bout of chemotherapy is just skeletal. Not today. 4 weeks later, that person's up, walking. By the way, I also corrected a 10-year hyperpronation on the right knee. Excuse me. So it's very important to realize that doesn't happen by itself. That's why you have to look at all the fruits and vegetables and getting them into the juice form, because the juice is what has loads of enzymes and these protective nutrients that I'm mentioning right now. So if you want to have a greater immune system and guard against a variety of cancers, including leukemia, cancer of the colon, the lung, breast, liver, and skin, these chemicals in the apples help do that. They also help protect against stroke. They thin the blood. Sorry, I was lecturing last night. I did a long Zoom lecture last night. My last lecture was 8 hours nonstop. By the way, Roland, who's worked with me for 35 years, part of our filming team, and we're filming all over the place now. I'm finishing up 3 major films. I'm hopeful to have one film finished to premiere in 2 months. So, looking forward to that. But anyhow, he's got the 8 hours and he's editing it down to make it more manageable for most people, but keeping all the important information in. So it's coming, but it'll take about a month. Now let's go to apricots. This has a long history in the medical practice in China and India. In traditional Chinese medicine, apricots and their kernels, though I don't recommend the kernels, were prescribed for the treatment of asthma and cough and constipation. It's very good in vitamin C and vitamin K, beta-carotene, thiamine, niacin, iron. And Japanese scientists have studied the ability of apricots to inhibit the pathogenic bacteria associated with ulcers and acute gastritis. So what I do is, I did this a long time ago, but it worked. I was working on a very important research project called the Man Who Saved the Romanovs. Because if you knew the actual history, the Romanovs were not killed and massacred in Ekaterinburg under a secret codicil in the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk by Kerensky, who was running Russia at that time. They were escorted out through Malta. Anyhow, that's a whole discussion by itself. But the man who was the chief editor at the New York Herald Tribune, named Guy Richards, very astute journalist. He and I were working together on this, and he had ulcers. One day he said, I can't make it today. And then another day, can't make it. And I asked him why, and he told me. I said, fine. Drink raw cabbage juice. And he said, why? I said, because the raw cabbage juice has what you might consider, though it hadn't been identified as a vitamin like H, and that can help heal the, generally, one of the primary causes, Helicobacter, E. pylori. So then I did some additional research, and I started using apricots, juicing the apricot, and blending the juiced apricots with cabbage juice. And almost everything that was a problem in the intestines was reversed. Something to think about. So it does work. It works against and inhibits pathogenic bacteria associated with ulcers. Then you have bananas. They're good. They're low in calories. They provide essential nutrients like B6 and C and potassium, very good in potassium, and manganese. They also stimulate probiotic activity, which sustains a healthy gut flora. And bacteria in the gastrointestinal system is critical for the proper digestion and absorption of your nutrients. Bananas help keep this system on track. In fact, recent findings indicate that bananas may offer protection against kidney cancer, particularly in women, and aid renal function. I'll do one more today. Blueberries, one of my favorite. Anyone suffering from cognitive decline, mental problems, brain problems, I load them up on blueberries. I mean, I'm talking about a lot. I won't go into how much, but it's a super amount of blueberries each day, because a blueberry is just a goldmine of health benefits. It doesn't matter. It could be black, blue, or red varieties are especially known for the antioxidants they contain. And blueberries in particular have what are called flavonoids and phenolics and polyphenol compounds, all of which have the ability to reverse cellular aging of cognitive and motor functions. It rejuvenates your brain. In one recent study, the antioxidant levels of 100 foods, blueberries was number one. Now you can juice blueberries. You'll miss the fiber if you do, though you can keep the fiber separate and put it into a smoothie. You won't get a lot of juice. You have to juice like 2 quarts to get what would be like 4 ounces. But boy, that will be 4 very potent ounces going into your system. Now, other studies have shown that blueberries protect brain health, improve memory, and sustain coordination by, for one, enhancing communication between your nerve cells. And this activity provided protection against serious neurodegenerative diseases like dementia and Alzheimer's. So blueberries also have anti-inflammatory properties that protect the skin and the joints and cardiovascular and neurological systems. So when you consume blueberries, you're getting a proven benefit if you're a diabetic, because it's one of the fruits you can eat that won't raise your blood sugar, but really helps stabilize it. So blueberries also prevent bone loss, inhibits cancer cell proliferation, particularly if you have prostate or colon cancer. So we're 23 minutes into the program. That's why I said it's a classroom on the air, and I'm only through a few of these. Each day I'll add more. All right? And everything is a jumping off point. So if you want more on blueberries, go to the Library of Medicine and just Google blueberries healing or health benefits, and all those thousands of studies suddenly come into vogue. So that's important. All right? We're going to take a break, and when we come back from the break, we're going to play a clip. And the clip we're going to play is from Kim Iverson, Iversen. She has a good background in journalism, and she's going to challenge Anthony Fauci. Remember, this is the Anthony Fauci who would not support a known and proven medicine, Bactrim, for those with a pneumocystis disease of the lungs. And that's where the first group of people dying of AIDS, they were dying of that or Kaposi's sarcoma. And so he would not support it. And as a result, it's estimated that around anywhere from 60 to 75,000, mainly gay men, died because of that. And those who were aware of it and were using it, and I was certainly promoting it because I was working with over 1,200 people within the AIDS community, probably 95% men, and we did a whole detoxification process, and not a single person died. All of them got well. 18 of them, we reversed their HIV condition. I had a team of 22 board-certified physicians and nurse practitioners and a whole group. That we gave colon therapy, every therapy you could imagine, were all integrated into this approach. And yet nobody except journalists within the African-American community, they were open and came. And we were heavily vetted. I remember the guy from Tony Brown's Journal who was the number one program on PBS at the time, spent months interviewing people and looking at the medical records with the patient's permission. They'd sit there and go and say, and when they absolutely were convinced, because they had the hard data and a human being with photographs, that the patient would have when they were very sick and now today vibrantly healthy. And that's when I was invited on. So they did a vetting system, and that was unlike any I've ever seen. And yet you would never know that existed. And Anthony Fauci was aware, because we sent him invitations to come to the center, to interview the medical staff, to interview the patients. No one, not the New York Times, no one wanted to know that truth. She will allude to that in this. Mind you, I have no knowledge of her, but she's the only main journalist that I've seen who's had the courage to take on Anthony Fauci. Because if he lied then, if he was a monster then, if he caused hundreds of thousands of deaths by promoting AZT and not promoting something would help, then suddenly he became an angel? What the hell's wrong with the media today? You judge. Back in a moment.
On your radar.
Well, in June of 1981, reports came out of five otherwise healthy gay men in Los Angeles who'd come down with PCP, a type of pneumonia typically caused by a suppressed immune system. Doctors and scientists were baffled by the novel disease. They had no idea what was causing these otherwise young, healthy men to become gravely ill. One such scientist who took an interest in researching the novel disease was Anthony Fauci. At the time, the first reports of the illness, Fauci was working his way up in the bureaucracy of the NIH. At the time, Fauci was working on other things, but he was so intrigued by the novel disease that he began dedicating much of his time to it. In 1984, Anthony Fauci was named the head of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, a title he still holds to this day. And public panic regarding AIDS, which had finally been given a name the year before, had firmly taken over the nation. Public panic intensified, partly because of comments made by Fauci regarding transmission of the virus. In the early 80s, the public believed AIDS was a sexually transmitted disease that only affected gay men. But after the discovery of an infant being diagnosed with the virus, Fauci made comments in the Journal of the American Medical Association claiming the possibility that routine close contact, as within a family household, could spread the disease. This news immediately set off alarm bells as mainstream news outlets such as AP and the New York Times began reporting on household transmission of AIDS. ABC News sat down with Fauci regarding this new alarming development.
Given the long incubation period of this disease, we may be starting to see, as we're seeing virtually as the months go by, other groups that can be involved. And seeing it in children is really quite disturbing.
When you say other close contact, give me some examples.
Well, for example, if the close contact of a child is a household contact, perhaps there will be a certain number of cases of individual who are just living with and in close contact with someone with AIDS or at risk of AIDS who does not necessarily have to have intimate sexual contact or share a needle, but just the ordinary close contact that one sees in normal interpersonal relationships. Now, that may be far-fetched in the sense that there have been no cases recognized as yet in which individuals have had merely casual contact, close albeit, with an individual with AIDS who, for example, have gotten AIDS. For example, there have been no cases yet reported of hospital personnel who have fairly close contact with patients with AIDS. There have been no case reports of them getting AIDS. But the jury is still out on that, because the situation is constantly evolving, and the incubation period is such so long. As you know, it's a mean of about 14 months, ranging from 6 to 18 months. So what medical researchers and public health service officials are concerned with is what we felt were the confines of transmissibility now going to be loosening up and broadening up, so that something less than truly intimate contact can give transmission of this disease.
Well, of course, we now know that the infant contracted the virus through their mother's womb, but the damage had been done. Public panic had intensified, and people were fearing they could get AIDS from sharing a toilet seat or even from shaking hands. People living with AIDS were being alienated and ostracized from their jobs, homes, communities, and gay men in particular were heavily stigmatized. On the treatment front, Fauci and the team of scientists at the NIH began frantically working on a vaccine, believing that would be the way to end the AIDS epidemic. Confident in their work, Health and Human Services Secretary Margaret Heckler declared in 1984 that an AIDS vaccine would be ready for testing within 2 years. But banking on a vaccine proved to be harder than it seemed. 2 years passed and there wasn't one even ready for testing. The public was losing patience. Pharmaceutical companies were also racing towards a treatment for AIDS, realizing the incredible potential for profits. In 1987, one such company was Burroughs Wellcome, a British drug company who showed in a test tube that their failed cancer drug, AZT, could be repurposed to treat AIDS. Limited studies were done, long-term side effects were unknown, but in record speed, in less than 4 months, the FDA approved the drug as a treatment, claiming the benefits outweigh the risks. One of the parameters of the speedy approval process was for the drug company to bring back follow-up data in 2 years. Burroughs Wellcome agreed, but of course, since the drug was already approved, they never really needed to follow up. And so they didn't. Celia Farber did incredible reporting on the approval, use, and dangers of AZT for Spin magazine in the late 80s. In her article titled Sins of Omission, she writes, quote, "The majority of those in the AIDS-afflicted and medical communities held the drug up as the first breakthrough on AIDS. For better or worse, AZT had been approved faster than any drug in FDA history, and activists considered it a victory. The price paid for the victory, however, was that almost all government drug trials from then on focused on AZT, while over 100 other promising drugs were left uninvestigated." Now, the expensive drug made Burroughs Wellcome record profits, and at the time, it was the most expensive drug ever marketed. But people were desperate. They would do anything to get their lives back. Despite numerous doctors raising concerns about the toxicity of the drug, some even saying that it was doing the very opposite of what it claimed to do, that is, it was actually shortening the lives of their patients, Fauci and other health officials disagreed. In 1989, Fauci began to promote the drug, not only for critically ill AIDS patients, but for anyone who tested positive for HIV, including those asymptomatic who showed no signs of disease. Those patients included hospital workers, pregnant women, and even children. Doctors were stunned. The data the NIH released was limited, but nonetheless, the NIH had gone all in on AZT. Despite it becoming clearer and clearer that AZT was toxic, caused liver damage, and destroyed white blood cells, the drug continued to be used for several years after, while calls from activists and doctors to study any other possible treatments went ignored. One such treatment that was ignored was Bactrim. PCP was the leading killer in AIDS patients, and many doctors were prescribing the inexpensive antibiotic as a prophylaxis to prevent AIDS victims from developing the rare pneumonia. There was evidence that the antibiotic should be used as a prophylaxis whenever the reoccurrence rate of PCP for a given condition was over 15%. The reoccurrence rate of PCP in HIV-positive patients was over 60%. Despite the science, Dr. Fauci declined to conduct a clinical trial. Doctors and advocates continued to push for its use, and finally, a couple years later, it was adopted after thousands of patients had already died. As Fauci and the NIH focused on vaccines and AZT for the treatment of AIDS, hundreds of drugs went unstudied, many of which were demonized. In fact, the movie Dallas Buyers Club is about treatments AIDS patients desperately sought after because of the inability to access them legally. Many doctors advocated that the best way to treat patients was to focus on mitigating the severity of the ailments that would ultimately kill them rather than trying to eradicate AIDS altogether, that the virus mutates too quickly to waste all resources and time on a vaccine or other preventatives, that everything should be studied, all avenues explored, and all options should remain on the table. But unfortunately, that's not exactly how the AIDS epidemic was handled. Big Pharma got their payday in AZT. Millions of dollars allocated by Congress went to vaccine research, which never produced anything effective. And meanwhile, along the way, hundreds of drugs and treatment options went unexplored. And we still don't have a cure for HIV. The epidemic never went away like people hoped. We do, however, have effective treatments that help people live a good long life with the virus. There were a lot of mistakes made along the way, a lot of lessons that could have been learned. But after looking into the history of the AIDS epidemic, it's curious if we've actually learned any. Here we are today with a pandemic that is causing mass hysteria. Like the days of people demonizing gay men as the culprits behind the epidemic, we have the media demonizing the unvaccinated as the root cause for why this virus just won't go away. Many hoped the vaccine would stop the spread and eradicate the virus, but like AIDS, the virus seems to mutate too quickly. The same way Fauci discouraged and even prevented inexpensive treatments from being talked about, researched, and prescribed back then is the same thing that is happening today. And in the end, with the lack of a promising cure and a realization that the virus is likely here with us to stay, many who fear exposure to HIV have chosen to wear a condom to protect themselves, just like those who fear exposure to COVID are choosing to wear a mask. In reality, our government officials should be working on absolutely everything from every angle to attack this virus, from vaccine developments and PPE gear to treatments, protocols, vitamins, health routines, and repurposing other drugs. They should be using our tax dollars to study inexpensive treatments that Big Pharma has zero interest in studying because they can't make billions off of them. And yes, Big Pharma should also continue to try and find a cure or a vaccine. Everything should be tried. Nothing should be spared. Nothing should be demonized. Everything should be studied. But just like what happened during the AIDS epidemic, that just doesn't seem to be happening.
Down. I would suggest that someone in the audience download from GaryNall.com The Cost of Denial. She said that there is no cure for AIDS. There was always a cure for AIDS. We have the evidence. It is completely documented. We have affidavits. In fact, The Cost of Denial, produced in Celia Farber, that she just read from there, an outstanding multi-award-winning journalist, was the narrator, and they spent enormous amount of time going through the archives. They found all these doctors, nurses, patients, and all those people that they had, including people you see in The Cost of Denial, were all cured. And yet they were full-blown AIDS, not just asymptomatic. So send her, let her know. The truth is still being withheld for the same reasons. Yeah, ivermectin, it works. We've shown you the actual studies, cited them. Hydroxychloroquine in combination, both prophylactically and in therapy. Monoclonal antibodies, so there are side effects to that, but it still works in the first 10 days, can help people. So we have a lot. In fact, if you remember just last week, I read from the actual medical library how many studies specifically on COVID of vitamin D, vitamin C, even aspirin, better than any drug that they've created on for COVID. And yet, all that's blocked by Anthony Fauci and the people in power, all because of the profit. It's all about the profit. So, something to think about. By the way, I'm going to be re-premiering the documentary, Last Call for Tomorrow, A, because we were packed and our bandwidth was not wide enough. Also, we had someone who came in on, thought the movie hadn't started and started the movie after the coming attractions were already playing. So we went through a whole glitch problem for about the first 15 minutes. That won't happen this time. Also, we're going to have an interview with some very important persons right after the film that no one has seen before about the environment and realists. I'm trying to set up an interview right now with a person who was, nobody wanted to have him on because he was like apocalyptic. He was correct. What he was wrong about was the timetable. He made the mistake of giving a timetable 5 years ago. He was off. But what he predicted has happened, and now I'm saying, let's take a closer look at that. So it really gets bad. So on October 16th at noon, which is a Saturday, we will premiere, for everyone who didn't see it, the full award-winning, and by the way, the most awards of any film in film festival history. And by the way, Cost of Niles also number one this year. In all the film festivals around the world, we're talking about the most respected and honored film festivals, best film, best environmental film, etc. So it's a powerful one-two punch, two films in a row. But this is Last Call for Tomorrow, and boy, do we need it. All you have to do is look at the headlines right now. I mean, things that are happening even today in the paper. I read that for the first time they're having rain in Greenland on this body of ice, and it could be catastrophic. What can happen from that? This is the new norm. There's all types of things happening. I'll give you just a few examples. This is from Common Dreams, Jenna McGuire. Quote, climate-driven weather disasters increased 500% over the last 50 years, according to the UN, and has killed more than 2 million people at a cost of $3.64 trillion in economic damage just since 1970. That's just one example. But every time I look around, I'm saying, why aren't we paying attention to this? This is another one. This is just out. This is from Paul Gilding. And it says, why the climate emergency is now the methane emergency. Quote, we're about to go through the most profound shift in the climate debate in 20 years. The result will be the end of the gas industry's hope of being a transition fuel, a brutal market disruption in the agriculture and livestock industries, and the arrival of the climate emergency into public consciousness. This will be driven by the acceptance of methane as the critical response to climate emergency. Then it goes into methane. Remember, when you melt, let's say, big blocks of frozen tundra in Siberia and in the boreal forests across the northern latitudes, you release all this methane, which is far more powerful contributing global warming than CO2. And it's happening now. It's not the future. It's right now as we speak. So just keep that in mind. And also, probably one of the biggest things we're not being honest about in the United States is that from here throughout your lifetimes, there's not going to be the water that is needed for over one half the United States. And on the other side, we have Bill Maher doing a report on water, and why don't we just bring pipelines? And yeah, that's it, Bill. Well, that doesn't work. First of all, because 90% of the water that comes down in these torrential storms, even today down in Houston, they might get many feet of water because it's clay. You get 19 inches of water in one day in rain, you could have 4 or 5 feet because there's no place for the water to go. So when water does come to areas of the United States, mainly the east, it runs off. It's not going into the aquifers. And the largest aquifer in the United States, the Agualaguan, is over half empty, and it's a critical because, irony of ironies, the people are moving to the very locations that are least sustainable for the future. They're moving where the fires are, where the hurricanes are, the tornadoes are, the drought is. That makes no sense, and yet that's exactly what the studies show. So right now, this is from Common Dreams, as the climate emergency offers repeated signals, quote, it's an extreme new world. Loudest alarm bell yet. Unprecedented water shortages declaration for the western United States. So even though we have Lake Mead, the biggest U.S. reservoir by volume, it's about 1,067 feet and 35% capacity. That's 35%. That means it's lost 65% of its capacity, putting it at the lowest level since the lake was filled after the Hoover Dam was completed in the 1930s. So that's going down in that Colorado River Basin. It's in an extended drought, extreme temperatures, expansive wildfires, and some places flooding and landslides. And now it's time to take action, but they're not taking action. Nobody's moving. They're moving in the wrong direction or not moving where they should. Why? Why do you think? So it's here, and yet we're not making that an issue, and we should. But something else we're not making an issue, and I want to get to this very quickly. And I'll save some of the other commentaries, including I want to give full strength to the evidence against Julian Assange being recanted by the person that the U.S. government was using as their primary witness against him. So we have that information. But think about this. The Carnegie Mellon University study, between 1946 and 2000, the U.S. interfered in 81 national democratic elections in other countries. They were 59% successful. U.S. intervention goes way back to Woodrow Wilson's administration when he included the U.N. and its maritime blockade of Germany in 1918. They have done 1948. We intervened in Italy and in Syria, 1949, when Syria became an independent republic under civilian rule. The CIA supported a coup by the Army Chief of Staff's aim to end civilian rule. Once in power, Zaim conceded power to the U.S. for transport of oil, signed an armistice with Israel. Iran in 1953, well-known CIA-led staged coup to oust Prime Minister Mossadegh, who decreed policies to nationalize the country's oil and threaten the profits of British Petroleum. And, of course, the U.S. media, lapdogs that they are, with no ethics whatsoever, they declared Mossadegh as a dictator, when nothing could be further from the truth. Guatemala, 1954, the CIA involved in deposing President Jacob Arbenz and installed a military dictatorship that was supportive of United Fruit. That was under the Dulles brothers. 1955 to 1970, the support of the Tibetan insurgency to destabilize China's control over the country. The repeatedly, since 1959, the U.S. and CIA and the Pentagon have attempted to overthrow Castro, 63 in Vietnam, the Democratic Republic of Congo from 1960 to 65, they destroyed Patrice Lumumba. He was democratically elected as the country's first prime minister after gaining freedom from Belgium colonization. The CIA supported Belgium business interest and with hundreds of European mercenaries and supported Joseph Mobutu to seize power in a revolt. Iraq, 1960 to 63, Brazil, 1964. So what I'm just showing you, and I'm not going to go through all 80, but there's, you name the country, Guatemala, British Guiana, Cambodia, Laos, Ecuador, Dominican Republic, Bolivia, Indonesia, Greece, Australia, Portugal, Jamaica, Chad, Grenada, Fiji, Nicaragua, Panama, Bulgaria. We were involved in all of those, trying to destabilize them. Millions of people were displaced, murdered, tortured. Not a single person held accountable. Not a single negative column about who was responsible for this by the New York Times or anyone else. That's how much power they have. And yet, you want to believe these people today? Nikki from New York, your turn. Nikki, speak up, please.
Nikki, Gary?
There? Yes, hi.
Hi. I know you for years, back to 74th Street when you had your sessions and stuff, and also recently with the diabetic study. And I want to thank you for your bravery and your beautiful heart, you know, because I'm very worried. You know, my daughter is young and we both lost our jobs and we're very concerned about the mandates, and I have diabetes, and how do I protect myself? Every job now is saying, including Fauci now putting out there that everybody, you know, if you want to go to school or work, you know, it's really asphyxiating. And I wonder why we always have to wait for things to be like, to look back instead of, you know, like be reactive. You know, there's so many parallels. I think of 9/11, how people were denied, you know, they were getting sick and they didn't care back then, and Love Canal, and there's so many, and like AIDS, there's so many parallels to this, you know, and like you said, why are we so easily convinced that they're telling us the truth when they've never been accountable? And again, I thank you for that. You know, what can I do? I mean, short of getting a fake ID or something, but, you know, I need a job, and, you know,
okay,
I'm in court.
Okay, no, Nikki, you need... Nikki, please, you need to protect your life first and foremost. It's a simple principle, Occam's razor. Use the razor to cut through the fat to get to the issue, and it's almost always the most correct one, move. I believe that the only chance people have now, aside from legal battles, is, but that could take years, is to look around the United States and ask which states allow me freedom of choice, the sanctity over my own body and my choices, and which are also environmentally sustainable and have a group of people that I could associate with, jobs that I could do. And New York is not one. New Jersey is not one. California, Washington is not one. You've got to find the right place. And let me tell you, I'm seeing thousands of people moving out of New York and finding that the New York that we all loved and appreciated, it's changed. Not for the better. It will not die, but it will not be what it once was. So we, all of us, have to be able to say, now I'm ready to start the next step of my journey. All right? We're going to go to Richard Gale right now. James, hold on, from Texas. Richard Gale, we've been told, and they're promoting the idea that if you're unvaccinated, you're 1,100% more likely to get COVID and with serious consequences, hospitalization and death. What has your independent research found to corroborate that or challenge it?
Well, we have, I think everybody needs to be cognizant of this, is that we still have a very huge dilemma here, and that is that all these statistics that are being touted about are relying upon diagnostic testing that is shoddy. And I'm not just speaking about the PCR, which we know has been misused and to be able to orchestrate much of the kind of figures to allow these policies to unfold. But this also goes for all the other tests. We have no accurate testing, and so there's always mixes of false positives and mixed negatives, and false for what? That's the actual SARS strain or another strain, which is a very minor common cold virus that we've all been getting during the entire course of human history, very likely. So, but what we're seeing now when they're speaking about this, the numbers in the unvaccinated, well, Case Western University, along with Harvard, found that, you know, that the vaccinated are losing their immunity as much as 80% within 6 months or less. That was particularly under the Pfizer shot, but that's also being seen with the Moderna vaccine as well. And there's just so many of the so-called, you know, breakthrough cases. It's kind of a misnomer. It's a horrible term to be using, but among the fully vaccinated, and that's kind of accounting for 14% of the hospitalizations and 16% of the deaths, according to many of the reporting. So, you know, I think one of the things we need to really be considering is, after we listen to the science being repeated, there's no really good science behind anything we're being told. You can be sympathetic to negligence and stupidity for just so long, but when it is repeated consistently since the start of the pandemic, and repeatedly you see the data being manipulated and completely reinterpreted from what the actual data is actually stating, you just have to simply call out that at some point you reach that threshold, and you just have to call out the deception for what it is. So, I don't think we can really rely on anything coming from out of the CDC. We need to really weigh the risks and benefit ratio of any information that comes out of the CDC's mouth. This is an agency that has a long history of corruption.
I agree. Hold on. We want to say goodbye to our WBA audience. They're going to break away for their news. We're continuing at the top of the hour. We're going to play a clip, and this clip challenges the CDC. It wasn't just Tuskegee. It is now. As we speak, they're covering up data that impacted hundreds of thousands of young, mainly African-American, young children, mainly males, who are at risk of developing autism. That's their own study show that. So how is it you're supposed to believe one set of criteria when they're completely captured by pro pharma, and on another one where they've actually committed crimes against humanity, and these show their systemic racism, that we're supposed to say, that's okay. Do you see what I'm saying? How come one agency had been so deceitful, so captured, so much pathology coming, and yet suddenly you're supposed to believe them? Listen to this clip.
I have great shame now when I meet families with kids with autism, because I have been part of the problem. I shoulder that the CDC has put the research 10 years behind, all right? Because the CDC has not been transparent, we've missed 10 years of research because the CDC is so paralyzed right now by anything related to autism.
Right.
They're not doing what they should be doing.
When Dr. Thompson originally got a hold of me in 2013, he was one of the senior epidemiologists in the National Center for Birth Defects and Developmental Disabilities. And he was very much ready and open to tell me exactly what happened in the CDC regarding these multiple instances of fraud.
There's too much corruption, too much conflict of interest, and our children are paying the price.
Well, it is an incredibly controversial subject, to say the least. But those protesters outside the CDC here in Atlanta say that the information being provided to the public about vaccines is not completely honest. And all of it hinges on one man. This guy right here, a scientist you've probably never heard of. That scientist's name is Dr. William Thompson. And it was on August 27th of 2014 that Dr. Thompson made an admission that got very little media coverage, but it was a major statement. That statement read in part, quote, "I regret that my co-authors and I omitted statistically significant information in our 2004 article published in the journal Pediatrics. The omitted data suggested that African-American males who received the MMR vaccine before age 36 months were at increased risk for autism."
When Dr. Thompson revealed to me this fact that African-American males were more susceptible to autism when they received the MMR vaccine on time, the way he described it was the most alarming thing he had ever seen in his entire life. And when he was told by his superiors, which included Colleen Boyle, who is now the head of the National Center for Birth Defects and Developmental Disabilities, when he was told to cover up that fact, he said it was earth-shaking, that it shook him to his core.
May 2004, Thimerosal, the Institute of Medicine gives Thimerosal a clean bill of health and MMR, both, right? So it says that they're safe and there should be no further research. Thompson at the time, he's conflicted. He's already sent letters to Gerberding, he's sending letters to Walt Ornstein, he's sending letters up the chain, right, to try to protect himself. But he doesn't know Wakefield's going to lose his license and his career. He doesn't know the autism rate's going to keep climbing.
Keep in mind that not a single committee hearing has been held since that revelation, that a whole group, an entire department at the CDC, and it was known clear up to Gerberding, engaged in obstruction of justice. They put all that research that showed that about 300,000 young African-American males, 36 months and younger, would end up with autism because of the MMR vaccine, and they put it all in black garbage bags and threw it away, except for one copy that he kept that no one knew. Not a single congressional hearing by Democrats or Republicans. That's how captured they are. And by the way, for those of you who say, well, for the greater good, just remember thalidomide. Thalidomide was out there being used for 5 years before we saw the birth defects. And then all the children who didn't have arms or legs just had little stunts of like flippers. That's the consequence of not doing proper, legitimate scientific trials. So when you can say the rationale that we have an unknown 40,000 dead and another 600 plus thousand injured, many severely, many permanently, but compared to how many have received the vaccine, that's not too bad. What kind of thinking is that? Because you don't know how many more people, especially young people, who have no heart problems are now going to have blood clotting issues, microclots. And so we should not be arrogant on this subject, and have a nice day.